Michael Tonsmeyer joins me this week to discuss some of the challenges in running a craft brewery. This is Beersmith Podcast number 228.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 228, and it's late December 2020. Michael Tonsmeyer joins me this week to discuss some of the challenges with running a small brewery. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're offering access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also The Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give the Beersmith 3.1 brewing software a try. If you've not downloaded the new update, grab it now as it includes improved day storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, new add-ons, and much more. To download your free 21-day trial, go to beersmith.com today. Again, that's beersmith.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Michael Tonsmeyer. Michael is the author of the book Sour Beers, as well as author of the blog The Mad Fermentationist. Michael's also an award-winning brewer, certified beer judge, and founder of the brewery Sapwood Cellars in Columbia, Maryland. Michael, a pleasure to have you back on again. I don't know how many times this has been, but
yeah, no, it's been a wild ride since the last time I talked to you in February.
Yeah, if I recall, I had you on right before the COVID hit, right?
Yeah, and it's as a former government employee, I definitely had a couple of months there where I went, man, it would have been nice to be, you know, working from home and thinking about where I was going to get groceries rather than thinking about how I was going to keep my business afloat while we were closed for a couple of months there for the tasting room. But luckily, they've less opened back up again in sort of limited capacity, and we've used the chance to pivot towards canning and more bottling and things like that.
Should have kept your cushy government job, huh?
Yeah, but luckily I've got a wife who's still got a cushy government job. So that at least I've got health care, if nothing else.
So how are you doing? I guess you mentioned, I think you guys are on some kind of a limited capacity at the tap room. And then I think you showed me a can you've been making, right?
Yeah, so we've started bringing in a mobile canner and doing sort of canning runs of beers every couple of weeks. Honestly, we've been okay. You know, canning has a lot of additional costs associated with it, and you also generally charge a little less for packaged beer for whatever reason. A $6 pint of beer on tap sounds good, for a pale ale, but a lot of people probably balk at a $24 four-pack or whatever of 16-ounce cans. But we've been lucky. We've had three new 20-barrel tanks in the last couple of months, and we just signed a lease on a new unit where we're going to move all our sour beer production, all our barrels and our fruiting tanks and all that stuff to free up more room in the main brewery for more production. So
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, we were lucky to be small enough and have like a passionate following of folks who were willing to transition from, you know, coming to the tasting room once a week to buy a couple of beers to coming to the tasting room once a week to buy a four pack and a bottle.
Nice. How is the investment you've made in, sour barreled specialty beers turning out? I mean, some of those are really just coming to fruition now, right?
Yeah, our first ones came out a year ago in September, and we've done 15 or 16 releases since then. Honestly, in a time like this, it's really nice to have beers that even if they don't sell quickly, they just keep getting better or they keep changing. When you run a 10-barrel run of double IPA, that beer is just going to be going downhill. If you don't get out the door in 4 weeks or 6 weeks, it's really not worth much anymore. And luckily with those bottles, that's brought some notoriety to us. There's a lot of excitement for them. And they're also just beers that, you know, keep getting better and give us something to pull out on a Wednesday and say, hey, we've got a special case from, you know, last year. Come in, give it a try. Every Black Friday, we do a dark saison with some sort of dried fruit. And so, like, this year, we dusted off a couple of cases of last year's version with currants and dates. And people could try that alongside the new version that had dried figs in it. So it gives you something for social media, and it gives us a little something that not many other breweries around us are doing.
And I think you have limited distribution of some of the specialty beers, right?
Yeah, we hadn't been doing much for a while, but now that we got those new tanks in, we send a little bit out. We just sent out, I think, our biggest shipment so far to some great liquor stores near us in Columbia, Maryland, and Baltimore, and Gaithersburg. And so we're around, sort of limited basis, when you can find us. But the tasting room, the tap room, our website's probably the most reliable place to get our beers.
Nice. Well, let's see. Back on podcast 190, you and I discussed some of the business and brewing aspects of opening up Sapwood Cellars. And today, you actually wanted to talk a bit about some of the less glamorous aspects of brewing, including regulation, excise taxes, compliance, and all the other lovely stuff.
Yeah, honestly, this is sort of a good antidote to about 4 years ago. You had me on. We talked about embracing home brewing. And that was me sort of espousing, if you're a home brewer, you know, appreciate the things that home brewing lets you do. And this is, I guess, the less fun version of that. If you want to open your own brewery, what do you need to be ready to deal with? And as we all know, the government wants to have their say on everything, and particularly when it comes to alcohol production. I was dubbed the compliance person for the moment at the brewery. Scott deals with contractors, and he deals with all sorts of other things. And the thing that sort of fell to me was filling out our excise taxes every month, filling out all the TTB, the Tax and Trade Bureau, federal filings that we're required to do, doing our quarterly federal excise taxes, dealing with label approvals and formula approvals and all these sorts of things. It's not glamorous. I think a lot of breweries are a little bit lax with it, but as a former government employee, I try to take these things as seriously as I can.
Well, let's start with taxes, I guess. We all love taxes. You've been keeping you have to keep, I think, detailed daily logs, right, of the ingredients you use, how much beer you brewed, how much beer made it to the end, and then, of course, how you distribute it, I think, too, right, order to pay excise taxes, right?
Yeah, all of that stuff. And for us, in most states, you have to pay. There's a state-level filing, and then everyone has to do federal filings. And you can generally use the same logging for both of them. Sort of the key things that you want to watch out for is making sure you record the volume produced by fermentation. When you transfer beer to a bright tank of some sort, so you transfer beer that will be going into a bottle or will be going into cans or kegs, and then how much beer actually makes it into those things.
So I assume that glasses too, probably, right? So how much you serve from the tap room too, right?
So it depends. So in most cases, it's not the actual number of draft pours you do. For Maryland, we have to just say when we tap a keg, we pay taxes on that whole keg. When we, break into a case or whatever it is, that's the amount that gets taxed. There's growlers get a little confusing, and this is something that I had trouble with early on. There are two different kinds of growlers as far as the government is concerned. There is the sort of growler that if you walk into a brewery and you have a glass of beer and you say, that was great, I'd like to get a 64-ounce growler filled with that beer. They view that as a large glass with a lid on it. They view it as it's coming out of the same keg that the draft beer is coming out of. It's not taxed in a separate way. Or if it's pre-filled, and they view that as a large format bottle. And so if you are filling something in advance and you're taking a whole keg and putting into growlers and putting those in a display shelf, that has a sort of a different tax path. That's taxed if it was bottles or cans or packaged beer. In general, the federal government just refers to bottling. And when they talk about bottling, it's bottles or cans or any sort of closed packaged product. We track cans and bottles and crowlers and all that stuff separately just so I can sort of keep those numbers all together. We use Google Sheets. I'm sure people have, it's like Equinos is a big brewery software package that some people use. For us, it's easier just to have it on Google Sheets. All of us who do any kind of production have access to it, and everyone's responsible. If you are the one brewing the beer, if you're the one transferring the beer, if you're the one kegging the beer, you're responsible for inputting into that sheet for that day what the beer was, what the volume was that you measured. At the end, I can just take those. There's a summary tab at the end where it takes all those numbers, sums them up, and I can put them into the right slot on the, I forget, form, whatever it is that the federal government requires.
Now, I'm trying to remember, do you keep track of grains or ingredients going into it as well? As, I thought you had to report something about that. Start at the beginning. What do you have to report from the beginning of the brewing process, maybe?
It's sort of this big matrix sheet they have. And really, the thing that they want is just total volumes. You are supposed to record deliveries of ingredients. You're supposed to use usage of ingredients. But none of that actually gets reported. That would be a situation, say, you were audited by the TTB. They would want to maybe leaf through those things. But in terms of excise taxes, they want, they call it beer produced by fermentation. And so essentially, once you add the yeast, that's the key part. It really doesn't matter to them where the wort came from. If you were to, say, buy wort from another brewery, as long as there's no yeast in it, if you pitch the yeast at your brewery, you are the brewery of record. It is brewed and bottled or brewed and kegged by your brewery in your location. Contract brewing, we can talk about alternating proprietorships and alternating there's another one. We can talk about that. That may be beyond the scope of this. But essentially, once you pitch the yeast, that's beer produced by fermentation. Generally, it, again, depends on your state. The federal government is generally most interested in beer transferred to packaging. So when you rack to a bright tank or when you take a volume, that's a very important number for them. It's called the tax determination vessel. And so they're really interested in how much makes it into that bright beer tank, how much makes it into packaging. Some breweries will just treat their kettle as tax determining. And at that point, they'll just pay the tax as soon as however much wort they produce, even though they'll have losses along the way. It just simplifies the whole thing. And to give you sort of an idea of the numbers we're talking about, excise taxes become more important the bigger you get and the slimmer your margins are. For a brewery our size, we're not paying more than a couple $1,000s a year in total between the federal government and the state. Maryland, for example, it's 9 cents a gallon. So it's not a huge amount of beer when you're selling a $5 or $6 pint, when you're selling a $15 four-pack, when you're selling a nice, beautiful barrel-aged sour beer, because it's not a percentage in the way, like for Maryland, the consumer pays a 9% on the price of the beer. So for a $5 beer, they're paying 45 cents. And that same amount of beer in the excise tax that we're paying is, a penny. And so every month we have to do our sales tax and our use tax. And that's a much higher amount than the excise tax. So it's something where it's really about the government monitoring your production and less about necessarily the high cost of that.
Now, unlike other countries, you don't get taxed by alcohol percentage, right?
Correct. And that's at least part of the reason that, real strong beers are popular and are certainly more expensive, but not, say prohibitively more expensive than a session beer. If we didn't have that sort of that, say, force of England or somewhere like that, where lower alcohol beers are partly popular because they're a lot less expensive tax-wise.
And then, of course, this is all in addition to the, something like a dozen or so taxes you have to pay just to run a regular business, right? Can you maybe walk us through some of those?
we're lucky to have, I mean, it's sort of the modern age of do-it-all systems, and so we have a payroll company that luckily handles the I don't even know what taxes we, you know, employee taxes and withholding taxes.
Yeah, I think there's about 5 or 6 payroll taxes you have to file every month. And you're right, there are services that automate it quite a bit for you.
Yeah, and particularly at the moment, I mean, we were lucky enough to get a PPP loan. And so that, you know, took a lot of extra effort on our part to figure out, you know, who qualified for what and what hours and whatever we needed, because we're not a company that just has, you know, we just hired our, including Scott and myself, we have 5 full-time employees. We just hired an assistant manager, but it's, you know, it's easy if you have a full-time employee and you know what their salary is. It gets a lot trickier when your employees are primarily tipped. You know, we're currently paying all our bartenders $15 an hour plus tips to get them, you know, up in the same neighborhood of what they were making on tip minimum wage plus tips before this all started. Mm-hmm. And with PPP, it just became, it's messy. And that's kind of the message of this whole thing. If all of this really sounds brutal, you know, enjoy that homebrew, enjoy coming up with a new recipe. You know, don't worry that your temperature control isn't perfect. You know, it's great being able to walk into the brewery and punch some numbers up on a keypad and get that IPA to ramp up a couple of degrees, you know, to finish fermentation. But so much of our time and effort is spent on these less sexy, less interesting topics.
Well, and then you mentioned, I think, sales tax. You have, of course, income taxes for the state, income taxes for the federal government, right?
That's what's amazing to me is our alcohol tax is about we pay about 20 times as much in that alcohol tax as we do in excise tax. And to file the sales and use, they just say how much, what was your revenue that's taxed at this rate, and enter the tax and thank you very much.
Yeah.
It's, you know, 3 or 4 numbers, and the excise tax is for Maryland, we're taxed by the keg. So we, our system and different breweries have different systems. I know some breweries will take, someone has to log in. Anytime a new keg is tapped, they will, put it on a log and say, on this day, this keg was tapped or whatever. What we do is we just save the keg collars. And so those go into a box anytime, a keg is emptied and before it's washed. And I go around and on the first of every month, I mark the kegs that have been tapped but not emptied. So we pay taxes on those. And it really is everything has to line up. They want the amount of beer brewed to match. So Maryland now has moved to sort of the system is you tell them how much beer you had at the start of the month, what was on hand. You tell them how much beer was produced, how much beer went into kegs and bottles. So that's sort of the left side of the equation. And the right side of the equation is how much did you sell plus how much remains. And they want to make sure that all of that sort of evens out. So essentially they want to know total production plus existing. And that's the other side. It has to be what's left plus what did you sell. And that's sort of their sort of way of double checking your numbers to make sure that you aren't forgetting about a keg or that nothing went missing without tax being paid.
Yeah. And then I don't know if you have a gross receipts tax or property tax. We have some of those in Virginia, for example.
Well, luckily, we don't have to deal with that stuff, although we also have an accountant. That's something that if I had my own time, I'd be as an economist in my former life, I might have tried on my own, but it's great having someone who knows the ins and outs of that and has set up our QuickBooks and our we certainly have to track our major equipment purchases for depreciation, things like that. But luckily there is no personal property tax or something like that.
So getting away from the taxes for a minute, you also have to worry about compliance with a whole bunch of things, right? I think when we talked about setting up your brewery, you've got to get approval from the fire marshal. You've got to get approval from, how many bathrooms you have and all these other certifications as well, right?
Yeah, it's certainly the most annoying early on when you're first setting these things up and making sure that your space is, can be zoned and can be set up for that. But now that we're adding this second location, sadly, it's not right next door to us. We're suites M and O, and this is suite K. So sweet, L is between us, and because the space isn't continuous, there's a lot of issues dealing with how that space will be treated. Is it just a storage facility? Is it a whole separate brewery? I was talking to my friend Brian at Attaboy Brewing in Frederick, and they have a similar setup. And he said they have two separate licenses, and they are tracking any beer that goes from one facility to the other has to be logged and has to be put on their taxes as beer transferred in bond from another facility. So it's really time consuming, particularly anytime you do something new and you're setting up that system that will track it. And you find out pretty soon if something's not going to work or doesn't work, because it'll show up. I'd say that, it's the fire marshal, all that stuff was fine. Early on, it's just that concern that you're burning money on rent and utilities and employees and brewing, and it might push back opening by a week or a month or a year if you need a rezoning or you need something surprising comes along.
One of my favorite stories, I go to a gym, and the gym has no air conditioning, but yet the county made them install a double door system to get into the gym. Because
that's the rule.
Because it's energy compliant, I guess, or something like that.
But. Yeah, it's actually my friends at Right Proper had a lot of trouble. DC has a lot of rules around boilers. And they bought a brand new, beautiful boiler with automatic shutoffs and release valves. But on the books in DC, the law is that you have to have these manual releases and manual overrides, and you have to have a certified boiler operator inspected on some number of occasions. And I would just say, before you open, really look into your state laws and particularly talk to other breweries, because the brewery is going to know what hurdles they had to go through. And you may not be able to find a person, a government employee, who is a brewery specialist who's going to know about the boilers and the taxes and the regulations.
Well, that was kind of my next question. When you're starting up a brewery, how do you learn about all these different things that you're supposed to be doing? Because there's no one source that I know of that tells you.
Yeah, I think one of the best sources is almost every state has a Brewers Guild. For us, the Brewers Association, Maryland, BAM, they put on fantastic festivals. Maryland has, let's say, some negatives when it comes to opening a brewery in terms of the red tape. And we had to get a liquor license in addition to the brewery license to serve beer and all sorts of other things. But one great thing that Maryland has is that you are allowed to pour test batches at brewing festivals. So if you're setting up a brewery, I think it's a year or two, certain beer festivals will pull a permit that allows homebrewers to pour. And so you can take your homebrews to a festival, get your sign from Vista Print, get a couple of friends and a jockey box, and pour those beers and talk to people and get your name out there in a way that you couldn't if you had to wait until you were a certified TTB entity, which means you have to be brewing beer at an approved space. You can't just do it at your house. Mm-hmm. And that was really a great way for us. And it was honestly very surprising for me how many people we'd poured. I think it may be only two festivals. We did like one in February and one in maybe May or June. And then we opened in September. And how many people joined our mug club, or how many people were there opening day and said, I had that beer you brewed and you brought to that festival 6 months ago, and it was fantastic. And I just wanted to be here to, try your beer now that you're open. And so, figuring out what you are or aren't allowed to do for your state. So one of the amazing things about America is that, every state can handle its commerce within the state with a lot of autonomy. And so it's one of the reasons, though, that, right next to you in Virginia, and Virginia's got, is it 300 or 350 breweries now?
Yeah,
quite a few. Maryland, I think, just got 100. And Virginia is bigger than Maryland, but not 3.5 times bigger.
No, it's not that much bigger. But Virginia is not, not a business unfriendly state. I would say it's about middle of the pack if you look overall. So
sure. And that's the thing with breweries, too, is it can be, you can be a very business friendly state, but like Texas, for example, very business friendly, but it can be very difficult to open a brewery there, and their laws can be a little arcane and a little weird. Whether they have a lot of laws where if you're a brew pub, you can do certain things. If you're a distributing brewery, you can do certain things, but there isn't this overlap.
Middle ground, yeah.
Yeah, where hey, I'm a brew pub and I'm mostly going to serve on premises, but I'd also like to send some beer out there. And I know Jester King and some other breweries have worked hard to change those laws, but you know, it's always in flux, and that's something you have to be prepared for too as a brewery, that you may set up a business model and then a law can just change. And Maryland has been quiet recently, but there's been a lot of friction between the brewers and the distributors and the big breweries and the small breweries on what's allowed and what isn't allowed, mm-hmm. and what the limits are for certain things. You know, for a long time, you could only sell, I think it was 500 barrels in-house as a brewery, which is a decent amount. But if you want to be a brewery that does a lot of, to-go sales, that really can start bumping up against that limit. And we're lucky they raised it. It's 2,000 barrels now, and you can go up to 3,000, but from barrel 2,000 to barrel 3,000, you have to sell it to a distributor. They have to take it off site, and then they have to bring it back again.
Yeah.
And it's just, come on.
Well, I mean, we've run into this kind of thing with homebrewing too. Many years ago, well, not that many years ago, but just a few years ago, it was very common to have homebrewing served at, commercial venues or, fairs and so on. And in the last few years in particular, we've seen quite a crackdown where a lot of the states are not allowing homebrew to be served in places where commercial beer is being served now,
Yeah, and that's, I know I did a talk at Ocelot Brewing in Virginia, and I guess Virginia for breweries, it was very clear for the homebrew club meeting, they had to go to a separate sort of closed private room to taste homebrews, judge homebrews, anything like that. And then they came back out into the main brewery to, have a beer after they were done or whatever.
Yeah, and that's a fairly recent innovation. I mean, 5 or 10 years ago, that was not the case at all. So,
yeah, you don't want people at the bar accidentally drinking homebrew and have been realizing homebrew is delicious.
Well, you've seen it at HomebrewCon too. Usually, they have to have two separate areas at HomebrewCon, whereas before that was not the case. So.
Yeah, and sadly, like that's one of the things about laws is you be in contact with your Brewers Association, your Brewers Guild, because that's a great place to know what laws might be coming up, and sometimes you can go in front of your local House or Senate and argue, tell them what sort of impact this will have on your business. And I mean, like anything, you can be as engaged or not engaged as you want, but I mean, you really realize what sort of power a small wording change. In Maryland, the key phrase was, I'm trying to remember, it was that the local, so we had to get a county liquor license, and there was a debate over whether it was may grant a license or shall grant a license.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's shall grant a license, it means if you get your brewer's permit from the state, they kind of are required to give you the liquor license. But instead it was switched to may grant, which means we had to go in front of the local liquor board. We had to get a 2 or 3 months out, a liquor board hearing date. We had to be, fingerprinted and background checks and all sorts of things just so we could sell full pints. Without the liquor license, we could do samples, we could do growlers, we could do cans of balls to go, but we couldn't do a full pint.
That's interesting. You could serve a growler full of beer, but not a full pint, huh?
But they couldn't drink it on premises, but you could do, I forget if it's 5 or 6 6-ounce pours for a sample flight would be allowed, but only one per customer, and it had to be maybe a company. Sometimes you have to have a tour, sometimes you don't. And and for us, too, there's a big choice in Maryland on what kind of brewery you are. Are you a brew pub, or are you a production brewery, or are you a farm brewery, and it determines the annual fee you're paying. It determines hours you can be open. That was one of the compromises. We can't stay open past 10 p.m. And that was a compromise a few years ago. Even though our county liquor license says we can be open from 5 a.m. to 2 a.m., almost 24 hours, because we're a brewery, we are we are not grandfathered in. If we'd opened a year earlier, we would be able to stay open later.
Yeah, I assume there's got to be a big loophole for farmhouse breweries because they've been popping up all over here in Virginia in particular. So
yeah, it's often, it's a, in Maryland anyway, it's a much lower fee, although their hours are even more limited. I think a farm brewer, I was just looking, we're discussing with our farmer who picks up our spent grain. They're looking to maybe open a brewery. A farm brewery can only open stay open until 6 p.m.
Wow. Well, stepping away from the taxes and the compliance for just a moment, you wrote an interesting article on your Mad Fermentationist blog called The Economics of Opening a Brewery, which I do recommend folks read if they're interested in it, in opening a brewery. But can you summarize a couple of the key points here?
Sure. I think my biggest sort of what I like to tell people is worry more about how much you're selling the beer for rather than how much the beer costs you to brew.
Okay.
That if you can make beer that people are excited enough about to come to your brewery and buy directly from you, there is so much more money in that than there is in saving pennies on reusing yeast for another generation or milling your own grain to save 1 or 2% on the total cost of the grain. That making beer that people are excited about, or having a location that draws people in, that's in a walkable area that has, obviously at the moment that may not be the business model to look at. at the moment, I think the business model to look at is, sadly, it's the same thing it always is. Bigger beers, bolder flavors, something that someone is going to drive to you and find you, in our case, in a small, innocuous office park on Google Maps, and to worry more about that because the amount of money you get from selling a keg to a bar is pennies on the dollar compared to selling that keg yourself.
So give me some rough numbers. So if I sell a pint of beer for, I don't know what you sell it for, maybe $6 or something like that. So how much profit, so-called, are you making a net profit, I guess, off the, in the initial?
Sure. Yeah. Sure. I mean, and that's that tricky thing if you want to include,
rent. Yeah, all the overhead and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So sort of the baseline cost for us is around $1 a pint.
Right.
And that is ingredients and energy and things like that, but not necessarily employees or rent or things like that.
Yeah.
And that's for like, $1, $1.10 maybe is a double IPA. And maybe you go down a little bit to, 80 or 90 cents for a pale ale and maybe a little lower than that for something that, a brown ale, something that doesn't have a whole bunch of Citra or Amarillo. So
that's called your operating margin, right?
Exactly. And so we're selling most of our beers for like $6 a pint is sort of a normal beer, and then $7 or so for an IPA, and $8 or so for a double IPA, and a little more than that if we're talking about, like an imperial stout. Yeah. But then, even our barrel-aged sour beers sort of go from like $14 for a 500-milliliter bottle to $18 or $19 if it's in-house and vintage. And those beers certainly cost a little bit more to make, and there's a cost associated with the bottle and the label and the time and effort to fill the bottles, but really the cost is coming from our time and our risk that some of those barrels that we start aging and there's evaporation and then there's just barrels that aren't very good and that we're not going to sell. And sort of to put that in another breath, $6 a pint for a 15.5-gallon keg is like $600 or $700.
Mm-hmm.
If you sell that same keg to a bar, even if you've got some excitement behind you, maybe you're selling it for $150 or $200.
Right. So that's a pretty huge difference, right?
And not to mention that you've got the added effort of getting that keg to the bar. You've got to get the empty keg back again when they finish it. You might not get all your kegs back, and so you're at $100 for that keg if it goes missing. It's a real hassle. And honestly, I don't think beers are often go over as well when you send them to a bar. We've had bars where we've sent a fresh IPA to them that they've begged us for kegs because we send out so little, and we'll send them a keg finally. Hey, we finally have a keg that we can send out, and they'll wait 6 weeks to tap it. And then you see it
and
on
then it's not so good, right?
Yeah, you'll see on Untappd somebody's checking in, and we'll say, why is someone checking in that two batches ago's IPA? Oh, it's at that bar. Yeah, they're never getting our beer again. And you really have to be on top of those things. And I mean, I remember early on at Modern Times when we were sending out those first few kegs, bars would call and say, oh, I'm having a problem with the carbonation or there's something wrong. And they'd send someone over and it would turn out that they were pushing the beer at, you know, half the pressure they should have been, or the wine hadn't been cleaned, or, you know, any number of things. And I'm a big fan of having as much control over the product as I can. And, yeah. You know, one of our employees cleans the lines every other week. We deal with, you know, real draft system maintenance issues. We're pulling the faucets off and scrubbing them. We're going as far as we can above and beyond to make sure that beer is as good as it possibly can be. And early on, that's your reputation as a brewery, as a brand is what do people think of it? And more and more, how well is it rated online? And the more you can selectively control who tries your beer and give it to them in the best condition possible, the more likely people are to get excited about your beer and come back for more or seek it out or any of those sorts of things.
So you mentioned some numbers, you know, maybe $700 a keg if you serve it on tap, maybe $150 a keg if you hand it to a bar. And I forget, you didn't tell me how much does it cost to produce that keg roughly?
Oh, how many pints are in a keg?
I'd have to do, I don't know, 32 gallons. Yeah,
like 124.
That sounds good.
At $6 a pint, it's $744. And for us, the general cost for a keg is that our cost is $125 to $175, depending on.
Right. So, you take that out to a thing and you're not making much profit on it if you're giving it to a restaurant. Of course, the other option is to keg or can, I'm sorry, bottle or can that. And what does that look like?
Yeah. So our cost to can a beer is about 75 cents a can.
Okay.
And that is sort of all in, including, so we have a mobile canner who comes, so we are paying for them to send staff and a canning line. So that certainly, you know, adds the cost. But honestly, I did the math out at one point, and if we were going to can, I'm trying to remember if it was, I think it was three batches a month. The break-even time was 7 years or something like that on buying our own canning line.
Right.
So if you're not canning that often, it's better if you don't want to deal with that thing breaking and the wear and tear on it and hiring employees, because they bring employees, but we still need to supply two or three people. So it is, let's see what that would be. So that would be 124 time.
You had a lot of these numbers in your article, yeah, which is why I thought it was pretty interesting.
Yeah. So canning a whole keg costs us about $93. Uh-huh. And so, you know, you're looking more at like $200 or $250. The nice thing about selling cans to go, if we can sell cans to go, cans on site are great because you can send someone home with more beer. You know, someone comes to your brewery, they can only drink 2, 3, maybe 4 beers if you have lower alcohol stuff. But it's pretty easy to send someone home with, they drank 2 or 3 beers and they want to go home with a couple of 4-packs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even if you need to distribute that beer, the markup is a lot lower on cans at a liquor store. Generally, we're selling for about 75%, 65 to 75 to 85%, depending on the beer, of what we would retail it for.
Interesting. So there is still some profit there, but it's not anywhere near what you're making serving out of the tap, right?
Correct. So, in a ballpark, if we sell, let's see what that would be. So, 104. So we're selling like 31 6-packs out of a keg. So it's like $500 if we sell the same beer that we're getting $700 or $800, say $750 for on draft, sells for $500 if we sell it in 6-packs.
So this would be, and I assume this is through a sort of a craft beer distributor or something like that, right?
Oh, so that would be if we sold it direct.
Direct, yeah. And then, of course, when you go to a wholesaler or distributor, you lose a large portion of that, right?
Yeah, so we're lucky in Maryland. We can self-distribute, so we are allowed to not have a distributor. We can hand deliver if we want to put the beer in the back of our car and drive it. We certainly can. What we do is there's a great company called Free State, which is a beer delivery service. And they charge about 10% of the cost of the beer. And for us, that's usually worth it. They come pick up all the beer. They take it back to their warehouse. They repackage it with any other beer that's going to the same restaurants or bars or liquor stores from other breweries, and they deliver it. And it's just nice for us not having to touch it, not having to deal with it, not having to pull up in the no loading zone and hustle the beer out. They know the people. And at this point for us, it's been worthwhile just to have them do it because we don't do that much. Mm-hmm. If we were to get a little bit bigger and wanted to get our own delivery truck and maybe a part-time driver or something like that, might become worth it. At the moment, we're sort of assuming that as taproom sales return, we'll be canning a little bit less beer. We'll probably have more people through the door, have more beer going out the door with them. But for the time being, it's been fantastic.
Yeah. Another interesting aspect you mentioned to me before the show was distributing across state lines becomes interesting, right?
it actually became more interesting last week when we sent, I think, 3 kegs to California a year and a half ago. Again, I used to work for Modern Times. I'm big fan of theirs. We did done a couple collabs with them. And so when they called and they said, hey, we're having a big festival, I would love for you to send some beer out. And the woman who used to do compliance for them, she since moved to another brewery, but she's fantastic. And she said, hey, here are the 7 forms you need to fill out to register with California. It took some time and a couple $100, but we registered with California and we shipped out some beer to them in a refrigerated truck. And Scott and I went out there and poured the beer and had a great time. And now, so it's like a year and a half later, I just got a call from the state of California saying that I had filled out the right things for one department, but that I needed to register as a beer entity with another department. It is, different states are different. Sending beer to Virginia was very easy. It was, I signed a temporary agreement with a beer wholesaler in Virginia solely for those few kegs going to Aslan's anniversary festival last year, and that was it. They paid the taxes, they dealt with it. Other states like California can be a little more daunting to get through.
And then I think we talked about this as well, but labeling becomes very important, especially when you start bottling and canning, right?
Yeah, well, and we're lucky. Maryland does not require federal label approval if you're staying within state. There are some states, and again, always check with your state, that anything that's leaving, say, the tap room has to be approved by the federal government. Generally, though, the federal government regulates interstate between states.
Between states.
Yeah. Thanks to the, I'm sure, some clause in the Constitution. And one of those requirements for beer is that you have to have a label that gets passed by the federal government, and they have a system called COLA, and that is their label approval system. And I would say, even if you're not planning on sending beer out of state early on, it's worth getting sort of like your template in, getting a few labels through so that you know how bold the government warning that has to be on the side, should be. That you learn things like that you can't say 7.3% ABV, you have to say 7.3% elk by vol or elk / vol. they're very sticky on the way you describe the volume. For our first bottle labels, we said 500 milliliters, and they sent back and said, no, it can't be only in milliliters. You have to use good old fashioned American units too. And so the next one we sent, we said, okay, 16.9 ounces / 500 milliliters. And they said, if it's over 16 ounces, you have to say pints and ounces. And so we said, fine. 1 pint, 0.9 ounces. And they said, very close, you have to say 1 pint, 0.9 fluid ounces to be sure that we're not saying 1 pint and 0.9 ounces by weight. So there are some of those things again, and once you figure them out and once you learn them, it's, it will be the same for every single beer, for every single label.
I think you mentioned some certain words have special meanings too. Like, I think you said something about barley wine.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, who knows what, I mean, a barley wine, I assume, is made of, is that Cabernet or a Merlot? They're very
particular. It's a red, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and anything that is not clearly beer, they want to see style ale. So barley wine style ale. They can be, they like to see ale, they like to see lager, they like to see porter. They don't like to see IPA. They don't like to see alt beer. Something like that. It isn't clear that it's a beer. They're a couple of those sort of key basic beer words that they want to see on there. And you can say IPA.
So apparently the subword beer and alt beer doesn't tell them it's a beer, huh?
Well, if it's B-I-E-R and part of all, you know, and those are the kinds of things. It's also a little tricky because sometimes you just get whoever the reviewer happens to be. For years, there was one guy who was doing all label approvals, and they've now trained up a bunch more people because not only are there thousands more breweries, but we've gone from the days where, I mean, I bet Sam Adams was doing, you know, two new beers a year most years, and now we just crossed over, I think, our 250th beer in, you know, 2.5 years, and that seems to be almost everyone's putting out new beers. People want exciting and unique and different. And that's, we haven't even touched on ingredients, but,
That was actually my next question. I believe you, you've done some, I think like 150 specialty beers, and a lot of those probably use more than the four basic ingredients. What are some of the challenges involved in that?
Yeah. So right before we opened, we were lucky. They put out, and I'll pull it up. It's like attachment number one. Exempted ingredients and processes determined to be traditional under TTB ruling 2015. So essentially, originally, yes, before 2015, I think pretty much you had to have, if it was more than, you know, grain and water and hops, you would have to get a formula approval. And eventually they kind of just said, you know, here are, I think it's 60 or 70 things. And it's a lot of things you'd expect to see on there. Apricots and blackberries and brown sugar and chamomile. And it says pretty much any kind of wood. They just say it's fine. You know, don't worry about it. These things are generally safe. There's some weird ones on there. You know, I don't know, like kale is on there. I don't, you know, how many kale beers have you ever had or brewed? You know,
not too many, actually.
Or bilberries. I mean, you know, I'm not even sure bilberries grow in America, but for some reason, you know, oysters are on there, oyster shells and pomegranates and pumpkins and raisins and rosemary. So it covers most of the things that most brewers would use most of the time.
But what if you use something different?
There's a system called FONAL. So it's the formula approval. And I think some brewers I talked to didn't realize this. And I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. So generally the only time that you get asked for a formula is if you are trying to get a label approval and the label says, brewed with sumac. Then whoever's reviewing your label is going to say, hey, it sounds like you used an ingredient that isn't widely accepted as being approved. Could you send us the formula?
You sumac because you ran out of hemlock, right?
I've heard Stan Hieronymus talk about people using choke cherries and not realizing the danger of them. And I do not want to belittle this system at all because I think it has a very important function in making sure people don't get hurt. Because the last thing any of us brewers want to do is injure somebody.
Right.
Not only would that increase the scrutiny on this, but I mean, that's not why we open breweries. It's not to, you know, give somebody trouble. Particularly at the moment, breweries do not have to list common allergens. So we do not have to put, you see on so many products, peanut butter squares, made with peanuts.
Yeah.
Or, you know, made on equipment that also processes. Alcohol is sort of outside. Generally, the FDA could regulate it if they want to. They simply choose not to at the moment. And so I'd like this all to, you know, stay safe, and we do everything we can to be safe. But it's very difficult when you have brewed with the ingredient at home. So I love using acorns and staghorn sumac is fantastic, and weird barks and juniper twigs and those sorts of things that many of which go back hundreds or thousands. I mean, juniper is one of the most common ingredients in brewing, for the first 9,000 years of brewing. Mm-hmm. And to get these messages back that, and generally, so what they'll say, they'll never turn you down. They'll say, hey, I don't see staghorn sumac on the FDA's grass list, and the grass is generally regarded as safe. The problem with the grass list is that somebody has to pay to have a compound studied to have it approved. Mm-hmm. And so what you end up with is that no one has paid to have, let's say, apples approved, but someone has paid to get a dehydrated tannic extract from apple skins approved. And so it becomes a little bit of a game with the TTB of figuring out how to phrase things. So let's take acorns as an example. I'm a big fan of Scratch Brewing in Ava, Illinois. They have a fantastic book, Homebrewer's Almanac, and they have this process in there where you harvest acorns and you dry them out a little bit and you put them in mason jars without any other microbes or liquid or anything, and you leave them for 6 months or a year. And during that time, they spontaneously ferment. They generate amazing like fruit and bourbon and old library book flavors and all these amazing things. And so I wanted to use them in a small batch of dark saison for the tasting room. I sent a message to the TTB with the formula. And they said, let's see the grass list. I emailed the FDA and they said, well, there's a gall. The gall of the acorn can be something, something. And so TTB said, no dice. I was talking to someone else and they said, I just asked for acorn flour. And that wasn't a problem at all. They just said I had to send in a process to leach out the tannins. Hmm. I said, fine. But I send the exact same formula with acorn flour listed. And I got a response saying that my submission was being denied because as a type of flour, there was no additional reporting or formula reported necessary. And so simply grinding up the acorns into a flour, for some reason, went from there's no way I can possibly use them to I don't even need to ask.
Interesting. Okay.
It's a little disheartening. And again, I know a lot of breweries just totally ignore this or are under the false impression that if you're not distributing air, if you're not getting a label, then you don't have to do this. I called the TTB and they were very clear that these are two sort of separate things, the label and the formula. Just because you don't need to do a label doesn't mean you don't have to do the formula.
Right, right.
And so you sort of learn the ways to phrase things. You learn sometimes all it takes is pulling it back and resubmitting it a little later, and maybe you get a different reviewer who has a slightly different take on it. To me, it's part of dealing with making interesting beers. Yeah. I think one of the biggest risks for our industry as brewers is all making the same beer because we are all ordering the same grain from BSG or Country Malt, and we're all getting the same hops from the same, five or six pelletizers, and we're all getting the same yeast from the same seven or eight, yeast suppliers. And you can certainly make a variety of beers from, those pieces. But if we're all getting the same fruit purees and we're all getting the same spices, it's a little bit of paint by numbers, or it's a little bit of you're all kind of whirling around in the same space, and being able to get unique local ingredients, whether that means getting fruit from a local farm that, is a interesting, unique, local kind of thing, or foraging for ingredients. And that's just something that you have to do a little extra legwork for. And ideally you get those approvals before you brew the beer. Because if you've already brewed the beer and you can't get it approved, you've really sort of panned yourself into a corner.
Right. Well, Michael, I am running up at the end of my time limit, unfortunately, but I just wanted to get your closing thoughts. Is it worth it? What's your experience the first couple of years of commercial brewing on your own?
Yeah, I mean, it's different than I expected it to be. We've been lucky that the response has been fantastic. I mean, it's really rewarding. When I was just about to leave today, I was out in the tasting room talking to our bar manager, and someone sort of signaled, and I walked over and he just said, "Hey, I just wanted to say that this coconut vanilla imperial stout I'm drinking is the best beer I've had this year." And that's not a feeling I would get from sitting in an office, working for the government, where that was, you know, it's great to have your boss tell you did a good job or give you a good review or give you a bonus or whatever. And it's great being able to take a week off and not worry about it and not think about it. And when you clock out at 5 o'clock on a Friday, the weekend is yours and you can, you know, go home and homebrew. But there are those little moments that, you know, wow, like I've really hopefully helped to build something with Scott and with our employees that has, you know, made people's lives a little bit more interesting, a little more fun, a little bit more, delicious. And that's, you know, I'm sure I'll get old after a while and I'm sure I'll burn out eventually, but hopefully by then, you know, we'll have a staff of brewers and, you know, locations all across the country.
Well, Michael, I certainly hope that happens and, appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for letting me talk about something that's a little less fun than we usually talk about. And next time, I'm sure we'll talk about making beer with black truffles and saffron and balsamic vinegar.
All those things sound good to me. My guest today was Michael Tonsmeyer, author of the book Sour Beers and founder of the brewery Sapwood Cellars, which you can find in Columbia, Maryland. Thank you again, Michael.
Yep, cheers.
A big thank you to Michael Tonsmeyer for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the Brew Commander, the new brew house controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with a new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to BlickmanEngineering.com. For more information, again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 Brewing Software a try. If you've not downloaded the new update, grab it now as it includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, new add-ons, and much more. To download your free 21-day trial, go to beersmith.com today. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.